A few years ago, The Guardian, which is a British daily newspaper, posted an opinion piece entitled City versus Country, Where's the Better Place to Live? In the article, Heather Long, a writer who lives in the country, provided five reasons why it's better to live in the country than the city. And fellow writer Jessica Reed provided five reasons why it's better to live in the city. And here's the case for living in the country. First, it's cheap. Dining out, going to the movies, clothing, housing, and other living expenses cost less in the country than they do in big cities. Number two, there's space in the country. Kids can run around and you can see the stars when they're out. Number three, there's less income inequality in the country. There are rarely any billionaires and very few millionaires who live in the country, which is not the case in the big cities. Number four is you don't have to rely on public transit, meaning your commute, if you have one, is a time for listening quietly on to an audiobook or just being silent. And finally, I thought this was interesting. You don't have to get suspicious when people are nice to you in the country. You, and I've found this to be accurate here, can go to the grocery store and have a decent chance of not only seeing someone you know, but carrying on a pretty long conversation with someone, say at Lampman's. And in country, sometimes you might feel like you're more of a genuine part of the community and not just one among millions, as you might feel in the city. On the other hand, Jessica Reed provides five reasons why city living is better. Walking is a thing, apparently, and you don't need to spend a quarter of your paycheck on maintaining a car or gas or things of that nature. Not only is walking better for your body, it's also better for the environment. So, number two, you're also never an underdog. And by this, I think Jessica means that cities provide opportunities for everyone, no matter who you are or what your interests are. Third, the entire world is at your doorstep if you live in a city. Museums, galleries, libraries, really good places to eat, world-class healthcare options are all outside of your apartment. And fourth, living in a city teaches you tolerance. Cities are more diverse than rural communities. City dwellers grow thick skin because they've seen it all and heard it all. And people can be real jerks in this city, but people from all backgrounds, religions, political parties, and persuasions also have to work together because they're so enmeshed in each other's lives. And finally, the last reason why Jessica Reed believes living in a city is better than living in the country is because living in the country, as she imagines it, is very hard. In her words, true country living means backbreaking work, including thankless chores performed before dawn, which I'm sure everyone has taken care of before dawn this morning. In the country, everything you do will be scrutinized. Privacy is hard to maintain. No such things happen in the city, where people could care less whether you walk around with your pet snake or like to wear a miniskirt in sub-freezing temperatures. Now, as I share these two opposing perspectives and the kind of silliness and overgeneralizations of them, I realize that I am speaking to a bit of a biased crowd. This is a country church in Vermont. Most, if not all of us this morning, came here from the country. And most of us, if not all of us, have made a conscious choice to live in the country as opposed to a city. And I think that this article does, however, get something very right, even if some of the particulars are labored, that when we talk about the differences between country life and city life or rural life and urban life, We describe them in opposition to one another. This wasn't an article about the benefits of city life and country life, sharing some of the similarities and praising the diversity of all human beings. No, city living and country living are seen as oppositional, and we're kind of asked to pick sides. Now, it seems like the city-country debate is an old one that goes back through the centuries and perhaps is even present in some of our scriptures. For books like Amos or the second half of Isaiah or the book of Zephaniah from our scriptures pronounce judgments over cities and proclaim wildernesses as places where God's new thing is about to take place. And John the Baptist goes out into the wilderness and proclaims the rulers of the city of Jerusalem are evil, and that people should come out to him to be baptized and renewed. Likewise, our Gospel of Mark has Jesus mostly in the countryside for the entirety of that gospel. And in other places, like our two scripture readings today, like from the book of Isaiah at the beginning and the book of Revelation, cities are used as a defining image of God's presence. Like, this is where God is, this new city, where God provides help and guidance. I think maybe some of the difference, though, is that in our scriptures, it's not an opposition. That those who are critiquing a city or leaders are critiquing bad governance, not bad cities, not cities as a concept. And likewise, those who are praising cities still use an awful lot of rural imagery, especially around the production of trees and fields and things of that nature as part of human life. That they aren't really in opposition to each other, but there are preferences for these writers. But our two passages today use the image of city as an important theme for what God is about to do. Our passage from Isaiah chapter 2 is a really beautiful one. The holy city, which is Jerusalem here, will be a place where God's divine presence and rule is in place. And the leaders of the nations will go up to the city and have their disputes mediated. God's wise counsel will lead all the nations of the earth to peaceful resolutions over conflicts, so that even the instruments of war are melted down and turned into gardening tools. It's the city for Isaiah where the peaceful resolution of conflict will take place, a type of city or on the hill or a beacon of hope, a place where people travel to make peace. Our passage from the book of Revelation also uses city imagery to describe the climactic moment in this story, the descent of the new heavens and the new earth in the book of Revelation. Written to first century believers, John's vision in Revelation serves as an affirmation that Jesus will return, bringing with him the ultimate victory against all that brings persecution and pain upon the earth. This is an important message for those early Christians who, by the end of the first century, had witnessed a series of violent persecutions in Rome's empire, in the Roman Empire's major cities. To hear that cities would once again be a safe place to live, where they could raise their families, would have provided comfort to this rather traumatized group. In this new city, described as the dwelling place of God, all will be comforted. Every tear will be wiped, and there will be no more pain. It's also interesting that the writer says there will also be no more sea, which is an odd statement until we realize that this book was written from the island of Patmos by an exiled Christian. The sea is what separated the writer from the people that he loved. Later in the chapter, the city is described as utterly beautiful and needing no sun or moon because the glory of God as its light. And later in chapter 22, a river is described as running through this magnificent city. The river provides life to all, waters nature's provisions, and heals the nations. Again, the city is seen as a redeemed place, a place no longer seen as hostile to God's people. Rather, the place where justice and love reign. A few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to go to a conference in the city of Rome. The nickname is the Eternal City. It was a Society of Biblical Literature international conference, and over the course of 4 days, scholars, composers, students, and clergy presented papers on a wide range of topics. I sit in on sessions all related to the biblical text that picked up on themes like food as a concept in our scriptures, the description of power and monsters in the book of Job, land imagery in the book of Exodus, animals of the Bible, and the weird story of Balaam and his talking donkey, and trauma theory in the book of Psalms. Presentations were scholarly by noted academics in their field and by students looking to further their research. Presentations were also by folklorists who played the duct flute, or an Israeli composer that had us listen to a piece he composed for the Balaam and his donkey story, where the donkey's voice was voiced by a trombone. And Balaam, who's kind of angry in this entire story, is voiced by percussion. And the angel who appears is voiced by bells. Presenters hailed from the United States and Canada and Russia and South Korea and Scotland and Italy and Germany and Chile and South Africa and Israel and Turkey and China, just in the sessions that I went to. And while English was the primary language spoken for each of these sessions, I also heard Russian, ancient and modern Hebrew, German, Korean, ancient Latin and Greek, Old High German, that was a really interesting session, Russian and Italian throughout my conference. And I was taken back. I mean, not only by the diversity of the presentations and presenters, but by the unique ideas that were being presented, concepts or ways to look at our holy book that I had never considered until that moment, ways that made sense or at least made me think more fully about a particular passage in our scriptures. And it was humbling to be able to hear so many different voices with so much insight, to be able to sit in on some of those conversations. Of course, I was in Rome too, not just at a conference, and seeing 2,000 years of Christianity and architecture and artwork, with Jesus depicted in 1,000 faces with 1,000 different hues, and walking through Jewish and Christian catacombs and reading gravestones that sound so familiar to our contemporary human experiences. It was just incredible. The entire trip was a reminder that our faith goes deeper, is bigger, and has more expressions than I could ever imagine. And this diversity of expression over time and location, this variety of religious experiences that all point to the God of our scriptures and the Jesus of our gospels, is really incredible. It's kind of hard to own the whole story of Christianity when it's that big. You know, I think there's a reason why city imagery is used, especially by those early Christians. Then the first generation after Jesus' death, the early movement had become multicultural and spread over an entire empire. At its very roots, it was an inclusive, diverse movement. You were not a Christian because you grew up in a certain town or a certain family or a church, because there weren't churches. You could have been any nationality or ethnicity, gender, or you could have been slave or free. Could have been in any housing situation or occupation or religious tradition or economic situation. The language of the city, with its diversity and identity, brought a wide-ranging group of people together. I think it's a great notion where everyone has to work together despite their differences, because they have to, because their lives are simply too interconnected to do otherwise. And that notion that we are all working together in the faith despite our histories and personalities, our different socioeconomic situations and occupations, that feels profoundly Christian to me. Not just a pleasant idea that some churches stress, but something in our core identity. We work together out of our incredible diversity. And as Christians, we should be deeply troubled, though, when we see in the news chants like "send her back," I think. Something that unsettles in us, because that sentiment echoes something that doesn't fit our experience of faith. But this rhetoric not only has a long racist history and dating back to the Jim Crow South, but it undermines the very ideals of diversity, inclusion, and the work-togetherness aspect that is so much a part of our faith. My prayer for us today, then, is that we remember the broadness of our faith, the many, perhaps countless, faithful expressions in this world, and be encouraged that we are part of something bigger than we can imagine. And I also pray that we push back when we see that image, the image of diversity and inclusion, undermined. Because our scriptures also tell us that we are all children of God, created in God's image, every single one of us. And we live this out this week. Amen.